Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, April 19th, 2007. Just a quick note, last night I was a guest, a little bit different venue and format for me. This was with the Coast to Coast Streamlink chat page, and that's something I have not done before. I guess a few people have been in that position, and so here's exactly what happened. I got an email, and of course, when I was on a show with George Norrie, maybe a month ago, month and a half ago, as a guest, George suggested that I might come on as a Streamlink guest. And here's how it works. Lex, the webmaster of Coast to Coast, emailed me and got me the information, and I had a special login session on my computer. So at 10 o'clock Central Time, 8 o'clock Pacific Time last night, I was online, and the Streamlink guests could come on and ask questions. They would type them in, and Lex was an intermediary. He'd put them in a little bin for me, and then I would type in my answers. And so I typed my little fingers off for about an hour there, and it was rather fun, fielding questions from the general public in that particular setting, because usually I'm a guest and I'm speaking. But with this, I was just typing, and I think I did a good job, but that was rather fun. So just wanted to mention that, and I'm not sure how available the notes from that will be, but I believe anybody who's on Streamlink can get access to the notes from that particular session. So it was the 18th of April, where I was guest with Streamlink, Coast to Coast AM, of course, out of Los Angeles. A great show where I've been guest countless times at this point. So at any rate, that was rather fun. I just wanted to mention that for people who are Streamlink members from Coast to Coast, you might be able to get those notes from last night if you missed the live session. Okay, and on that particular show, a couple questions came up, and I talked about some of the work that I did, and it seemed to be a point of interest. People wanted to know what I was doing, some of my background research. And I said, well, a couple of the things I can talk about right now, and I'm very open about these areas of research that I'm looking into. Some areas I don't talk about just because I keep it in the background. But one is electric cars. And what I've been watching the electric car industry for years and years, watching all the variations and the innovations that have come along. And the one that I really think has hit it on the head, nailed it, so to speak, is the PML company. They're out of England. P as in Paul, M as in Mary, L as in Lincoln, PML. They make electric wheels. Now, your motor, your brakes, your transmission, and everything are right in the wheel well. And this is a great idea. If you saw the movie The Italian Job, it was a movie about a bank robbery. The little Mini Coopers that they drove through the sewer system in, was it Venice or something like that? Anyway, in Italy, the Mini Coopers had been converted to electric because the Italian authorities apparently did not want gasoline engines. They were afraid of flames and fires and if somebody crashed, because they were scooting around the sewer system, they didn't want somebody to crash and have a fire in the sewer system, so they would not allow gasoline engines in their sewer system. So I thought that was rather intelligent. And so they got PML wheels, electric wheels, and converted the Mini Cooper. So it's a great system. Once again, there's you don't have a motor in the car, you don't have a transmission, And it replaces the brake system also. From what I understand, there's a small generator that goes in the car. So when you're parked, you put on this generator, or while you're driving, and it replenishes the batteries in the car. So a very nice little system. You can check that out online. Just look for capital PML electric wheels, and I'm sure it'll take you to all of the publicity and the website. The next thing I was working on that I mentioned online is wind generator efficiency. Now, I've talked about this before on shows, but probably not recently, so I'll go over it again. I know we've all seen pictures, and a lot of us have driven by wind farms, and you see the big tall towers, sometimes 200-300 feet tall, and they've got those three gigantic propeller props on them, and of course, most of the time you see those props just kind of sitting there, not really moving, because their efficiency factor is when the wind speed is 25 to 35 miles an hour. That's where those systems are most efficient. And also, if you look at a wind farm, about 99% of the wind blows right through and is not captured. So, of course, I put on my thinking cap and I said, how can you improve the efficiency of wind power? And so that's one of my projects, and I'm not going to go into the details on the show just because we don't have enough time, but it's one of my projects. I've actually had proposals in companies, and at this point they're not going forward with those particular companies. I have decided long ago that I work pretty much by myself, and I do quite well that way. And sometimes things take a little bit longer, but then again, I get to do things my way, and usually my way is a much better way than when things get into a corporation. Then they go, oh, well, I know this guy, and he wants to do it this way. And before you know it, you're back to those three prop systems that really don't work. Extremely inefficient. So anyway, that's just another one of my projects, ongoing projects, and there are efficient ways to gather wind energy, much more efficient than what we're seeing done to date. Let me quick give out at the beginning of the show, because I always forget this. I'm finding that more and more people, especially due to the shortwave show, are interested in ordering items by mail. And so I sometimes forget to give this out, so I'm going to give it out right away. So grab your pencil and paper. And I can't offer all of the books, etc., that I have on the webpage, the jmccsci.com webpage. If you can go online, I would suggest you go there for a complete listing of all the books, videos, CDs, etc. But for people that are listening out there, I have two main things that I like to offer. One is the books and the four-book set. I suggest you just send $60. I'll give out the address in a minute. And that'll get the four basic books, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, the small 60-page pamphlet called Surviving Planet X Passage, then the third book, which is Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection, and then the fourth book, the 300-page kind of little mega book dealing with sun and earth weather. Now, that we just call the weather book. The actual title is Principia Meteorologia, a Latin title. But these are all written for the general public, so the four book set, $60, and send that to JMCC. By the way, that includes shipping to the 50 states. So send that to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. Once again, that's $60 for the four book set, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. And the other item, which I just cannot imagine anybody being without today, is the Berkey water filter. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. It is a gravity feed water filter. There's no electrical. There's no pressure. There's no hoses. There's no connections to make. You just put the one container on top of the other and screw in the filter elements. And $315. And believe me, today with the water situation, the chemicals in water and the other pollutants, it is just incredible that people are without such a water filter. Now, you may have one online in your house, but the thing is, if the water pressure from your city or municipality ever goes off, that water filter in line on your water system in your house will be absolutely worthless. The other thing about the Berkey is you can take it with you. You can take it camping. You can take it on a vacation. Say you're going down to Florida, and the water is different there than your home state, maybe. And the whole family's going. You can take that in the hotel room with you and filter your water and have your own clean drinking water wherever you go. And this, to me, is priceless for $315. And I'm noticing lately that people are ordering two. And that makes sense. I actually have three myself. And one that I use every day for water just from the tap. I always put it in there, and that's the only water I drink. It filters out the chemicals and all the other toxins and bacteria, etc. $315, the big Berkey water filter. You get the two black Berkey filter elements, plus two extra ones, plus the free Cato 911 radio, which you can listen to this show on, and free shipping. That's the best deal on the planet for a Berkey water filter. And I insist that people buy those extra two water filters, because you will need them, just like you need a spare tire for your car. So that's $315. That's to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, Minnesota 55392, and on to the next topic. I just think it's so important. I don't have commercials on this show, but these are things that I absolutely think you need in your life. That Berkey water filter is very important. I would not be without it myself. And that's why I put it on there, because water is the number one numero uno thing that you will have on this planet if things go south, if things go bad. So at any rate, just a quick update, and I will be posting this on my webpage within the next day. I've been talking about this for a long time, but all of my books, when the Calculate Primes, my latest book, came out a little over a month ago, I knew it was going to sell out quickly. I didn't know how quickly, but it took about a week and a half to sell out the first edition. And actually, I just saw that we had 12 left of that, and I think they were sitting in a corner where they were forgotten. But second edition is out and rolling now, or the second printing of the Calculate Primes book. But here's what happened. All of my books sold out at the same time, which created somewhat of a dilemma for me. Popularity has its price. So at any rate, since all my books are going into reprinting, I'm going to offer a special offer. So just look on my webpage, excuse me, for that. And it will be basically $150 for the group of all the videos, which are now being converted, remastered into DVDs format. And so look for that on my webpage. I'm not going to go into detail because you can see it on my webpage. But here's what I want to say about in the reprinting, the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book is going into its eighth printing. The Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet has now in its fifth printing. The Atlantis to Tesla, or was that the seventh printing? I forget. The Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, is now in its fifth printing, and the Weather book is going into its third printing. And something I did, the books, of course, every time there's little errors, things like that are in the books. So I personally proofread the books because I wanted them out of this printing to be as clean as possible. And so I personally proofread the books cover to cover, all of my own books, some of which I haven't read in many years. And, of course, I'm the author, so I know this material thoroughly in my head, backwards and forwards. But what's interesting is as I read the books in order, I thought, you know, I really did a good job on these books. And I'm not just patting myself on the back. I'm trying to explain to the public out there that these books will give you a well-rounded education in how the world really works. Not just the world of science, but the world of politics and how the politics of science influence what we see and hear about in the standard news media, in the evening paper, issues like global warming, what is really going on behind the scenes, what does it really mean. These are all explained in great detail in these books, and you really get a good education, something that I have gotten, you know, somewhat the school of hard knocks. And that's because I didn't sit in an ivory tower all of my life collecting a government paycheck. I went out with my nose to the pavement and found out how things really work. And I bring that information to you in these books. So what I'm saying is I proofread all of my books, and of course the object was to correct any typos or that type of things, things that try and maybe clarify things a little better in this next printing. But as I said, it was very interesting reading my own books sometimes years after the original books were printed and see the train of thought that I went through to present this information to the public. And really, I was very happy, let's put it that way, with these books, because these books are written for all time. They're not a book that was written for a particular year or a particular couple of years. These are books that when I sat down to write them, I said in 100 years I want people to still be reading these books so they can get an understanding of how science works and the conditions of science during the times when we live. They're also history books, you know, telling the how science works today, etc. So I'm very happy with these books, and the next printing of all of these, they're all, the weather book went into its third printing actually today as we speak, and that'll be coming out here shortly. The Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book is coming up. The Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet is already done and on the shelf. The second printing of the Calculate Primes book, the book that came out just a month ago, is already in its second printing on the shelf and moving out quite rapidly. So at any rate, the Virginia Tech shooting. I know this is all over the news and you're getting angles on this. I'm not going to dwell on it. It's not really a topic that I cover on this show. All I'm going to say, and I'm sure everybody out there will agree with me, or 99.9% of the people out there, there's something very strange about what happened there. This just doesn't sound like an average kid that just all of a sudden went crazy and started shooting. There seems to be something going on here, and I think you know what I mean, and I really haven't been able to put my finger on it. Of course, I get input from many people who listen to radio, they listen to shortwave, they listen to all the different major programs that air every day, and so I get a lot of feedback and a lot of information. And it's difficult to sort it out, but I'll tell you something. Just my own gut feeling is that a lot more was going on behind the scenes at this shooting. You look at the timing. It was Monday morning. It was, you look at the political situation with the Attorney General having to go before Congress. All of these things coupled together, there just seems to be something underlying this whole event at Virginia Tech. And also the response of the university, which was totally bizarre. The fact that this went on for hours before anybody made a phone call, The list goes on and on. So I'm not going to say any more about that other than something more than what meets the eye was going on here. And, of course, the standard news media is, I don't even know what they do anymore, where they get their information. But nothing they're saying makes any sense at all. So it leaves one to try and put the pieces together yourself. So at any rate, that's all I'm going to say about that particular topic, but definitely something strange and more than what we're hearing about going on there. Today, as we speak, as I'm talking here, the moon is in what I call new moon passing. Now, we all know what new moon is. That's when the moon comes directly between Earth and the sun, and it's that little sliver up in the sky. And it changes from the morning moon to the evening moon. In other words, it's on the morning side one day, and after it crosses into the new moon, then all of a sudden it's in the evening sky, starting to climb up in the sky in its orbit around the Earth. So right now we were, the new moon was just a couple of days ago, and we are in the stage of what I call the new moon passing. And here is exactly what goes on. It's an electrical condition in the solar system where the Earth is in an electrical path with the sun in the plasma environment of outer space. When the moon moves between us and the sun, that's in the new moon phase, It literally blocks that solar wind and that electron beam that's coming out of the sun. And the details of this, if you are not familiar with my plasma discharge comet work, etc., this may sound a little vague, but basically the sun is continually pumping out charge, and part of this creates a sort of a capacitor or battery in outer space. And we discharge that battery on an ongoing basis. But when the moon comes between us and the sun, the moon blocks that. It's blocking that continual on surge of charged particles from the sun. And now it moves out of the way. That's what I call the new moon passing. It passes away from the new moon phase and gets out of the way, and all of a sudden that stream of charged particles from the sun comes pounding into our protective shield, our magnetic shield that is out in outer space, and it compresses it. And that's when this can trigger earthquakes and storm activity on Earth. Now, this is generally coupled with other electrical alignments in the solar system, and these, in fact, are not there right now. We don't have a lot of electrical alignment activity going on in the solar system right now. So this particular new moon passing, April 19th, 2007, does not look like it's going to cause any major events. But that could change if all of a sudden we get hit by a solar flare or some other activity occurs. We've seen where comets electrically aligning with Earth can cause weather situations. Something the ancients talked about, something that is denied in modern meteorology. They would never tell you in a million years that comets could affect our weather, when in fact it is well documented that they do. So at any rate, I just wanted to mention that tonight, April 19th, we are in the state of the new moon passing. And it's just, for example, let me talk about June and August. There are a couple dates in June and August, and actually next December, when the new moon passing on those particular months is going to be more significant, because we have other electrical alignments occurring in the solar system at that time. So more on that during those months, June, August, and December. I will be talking more about the new moon passing, but want to just throw that in, because tonight, as I drove down the highway, facing west, coming in a westerly direction, a very beautiful scene, a very beautiful 55 or 60 degree spring evening with that blue, perfectly blue evening sky turning into twilight with the moon sitting up there, that little sliver. Very pretty scene. This past week, I put a somewhat of a spoof commentary on my page, and many people on shortwave don't get to see the web page, so I want to explain what this said. And for those who did see the web page, I made a short comment about people with PhDs. Now, I myself do not have a PhD. I have a master's degree in physics. And so there's some kind of academic snobbery going on, of course, with people that go, oh, well, you have a master's degree. That's nice, but I have a PhD. And, of course, and my response is that I'm glad I didn't get a PhD. I didn't get a PhD. This was on purpose. I had ample chances, many chances to get my PhD, but I decided at that time in my life that I wanted to pursue other interests. I wanted to travel, and I'm very glad that I did. I went to outside this country. I lived in foreign countries. I taught in foreign countries. I got to know people in foreign countries. I lived amongst the poorest people of the world. And I taught the children of the richest people in the world. So I had an extremely varied background. I taught in universities. I taught mathematics, physics, computer science, and in foreign languages as a second language. So that was quite an experience, also getting to know the people and just in general traveling and learning about the rest of the world. So I sometimes look down my nose at people who spent their whole life sitting in a cold, kind of clammy university environment getting their PhD and never got outside of that environment. And my feeling is that those people are kind of like what I call big city hicks. You know, a hick we usually think of as somebody who lives in the country and, you know, has a straw sticking out of their mouth and a straw hat on and can't speak quite as well as we do. That's what we usually think of as a hick. But I developed an expression when I was in college. I went to Chicago for the first time and I noticed that these people, all they knew was Chicago. They'd never been anyplace else, and Chicago was the end of the world. I mean, there was no other place, according to them. And I loved Chicago. I still love Chicago. But it kind of impressed on me that there were some people who had never been out of Chicago, and that's all they knew. And so when they bragged about Chicago constantly, I decided on a term. I called them big city hicks. And just to kind of exemplify that I didn't think much of their, you know, attitude, and I've noticed this other places too. But at any rate, be that as it may, the idea that people have gotten PhDs and have never done anything else. They came out of college, they went into grad school, they studied, they got under a professor, they got their PhD, they got their first postdoc, position, then they got their first complete tenure track position, and that's all they've ever done. They've been handed, spoon-fed everything they've done, and I went out and I crawled through jungles. I got ran into bugs' nests where I had ticks crawling all over, thousands of ticks crawling all over my body at one time. Because I had something I was looking for, and I really did find out a lot. I found out a lot about history, about ancient history. A lot of the things I learned were because I did go out, and it wasn't all pretty, and I spent a lot of time by myself because there were just not other people of the same mentality that they wanted to go out and crawl through a jungle with a machete and get sunburned and eat conch out of the ocean because that's the only food there was, and drink coconut water, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot, and I learned that out in those places there were people and they were very nice, genuine, wonderful people, even though they were extremely poor by our standards. So I learned a lot about the world. So when people have PhDs, I kind of, you know, that's great. I really applaud their efforts, and I value my master's degree in physics very highly because I spent a lot of time earning that. I just didn't, you don't just get those, you know, out of a Cracker Jack box. You have to earn them. And I went to Tulane University, and I worked very hard for my degree, and just like people who got their PhDs. But anyway, I was on a radio show this past week with a guy named James Jancic. It's Feet to Fire. It's out of Chicago, a big Chicago station. And offline, we were talking about, and he said this is actually was a clinical study where they took professors who had PhDs, and they actually did studies on chemical in their blood system, like serotonin, which is a chemical that makes you feel good, feel relaxed and comfortable with yourself. And so, at any rate, they found out that professors, when confronted with information that did not set well with them, that didn't agree with their way of viewing the world, when those professors were confronted with material that didn't agree with them, there was actually a chemical response in the body that resisted change, that resisted acknowledging the introduction of that material into their life, into their circle of wisdom, so to speak. So anyway, I talked with James, the talk show host. He was telling me about this study. And I thought, you know, I've seen this so many times because of the area that I'm in, dealing with science. And of course, you're always dealing with professors or NASA scientists. And I've seen this reaction over and over again. You tell them something, you bring about a new idea, and you get this look. It's almost like anger. It's almost like you're insulting them. And, you know, so I've seen this actual, like he was saying, chemical reaction, clinical reaction to someone who was not, the way James described it, you were pushing them out of their comfort zone. And so, at any rate, as a spoof on my webpage this week, I decided on a term for this. I called it tenured professor syndrome. And just as a little bit more to add spoof to it, I wrote it out in Latin. And of course, in my education, when I grew up, I had 4 years of Latin as part of my education, which I'm very happy for now. But anyway, I rewrote this tenured professor syndrome in Latin, and it came out like this: syndromion professorius tenurium. I'll say that again. This is the Latin version of the tenured professor syndrome: syndromion professorius tenurium. And so, anyway, I put that on my webpage, and oddly enough, I just did it actually for a couple people that I had an experience with this past week who came across with this type of snooty professor type of reaction. But I was amazed that a lot of people really found it quite comical and wrote emails saying that they really laughed quite hard when they read that because, of course, they were in agreement that there's something about people who live in those ivory towers that they're just a little too removed from the rest of us, if you know what I mean. So enough of that, but I wanted to explain this to the shortwave radio listening audience because, as I said, many of you don't get to see my webpage. And I suggest that if you get a chance, go there. It's jmccsci.com. J as in James, M as in Mary, C as in Charlie, C as in Charlie, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, and I as in Indigo. 7 letters, jmccsci.com will get you to my homepage, and there's around at this time, there's about 2.7 gigabytes of information on my server, so thank goodness that I'm able to keep that much information there and get it out to the public. A lot of it in the form of my radio shows over the years, all of them archived there. And you can go there and listen to them, years of shows, radio shows. If you listened end to end, it would probably take you a couple months to listen to all the radio shows that are stored on that webpage. This is a startling result coming from Canada this past week, and this coming to me, a couple people thankfully searching out information and pointing it out to me, because I don't have time to search every place in the internet and on the web. So once again, thanks to those people out there who send information and point these things out. The Canadian government is making a study of 5,000 Canadians to measure chemical toxins in their bodies. This is out of Ottawa, and it began, apparently, according to this article, comes out of Ottawa, Canada. The Minister of Health up there had blood tests done. Apparently he wasn't feeling good, and he had some blood tests done. And what came back shocked him to the degree that he couldn't believe the amount of chemical toxicity in his body. Then he had his daughter tested, a young lady. You know, it sounded like she was like maybe high school age or very young at least. And she turned out to have higher toxin levels than he did. And then he became very concerned. Where are these kids getting this? Where are people getting these chemical doses? So the Canadian government put up $36 million, and they're going to study 5,000 people in Canada, cross-section of ages and living situations in Canada, to try and find out where these chemicals are coming from. And by the way, that's why I talk about a water filter, because that's where a lot of the chemical trace elements come from that get into your body, is when you drink water. We pour a lot of liquid water through our system every day, and these chemical toxins are trapped in your body and they build up. Mercury, arsenic, lead, all of these toxins that are extremely bad. So it's amazing to me that there aren't more people with serious illnesses and cancer. But at any rate, that's why I encourage people to have their own water filter. And by the way, I like the gravity feed water filters for one simple reason. If you have one of the pressurized inline water filters, if that develops a crack, just a very small crack somewhere in the filter, then all of the water is going to go passing through that little crack, and you're not going to get any value out of the filter at all. Your water is not going to be filtered at all, and you're not even going to know it. So with the low pressure gravity feed water filters, you don't have that problem. You're not going to have a cracked element that is passing all the water through there and not filtering it. So at any rate, back to the Canadian study. Now, when I read this, I thought, good grief, what are these people thinking? Of course there are toxins. You go to the grocery store, and there's a whole aisle dedicated to things that are so chemically toxic that if you handled these chemicals, you would get cancer. I mean, the soaps, the detergents, the cleaning agents, the things you clean your bathroom and toilet, you know, things you spray on the wall that dissolve dirt instantly. I mean, what is that stuff? It's got to be bad if it can take organic material like dirt and simply dissolve it. What's it doing to your body? And when you spray it, the fumes get into your system, and your skin is the biggest organ on your body. Now, there's something that you can do, and it's a very simple experiment. Take a clove of garlic and rub it on the bottom of someone's feet. Within 2 minutes, you can smell the garlic coming off the top of their head. That's how quickly chemicals migrate through your body. And so just try that sometime. That's a good thing, kind of a fun thing for kids to try, because it's not harmful, but it just teaches you how fast chemicals will move through your body. So can you imagine you're here spraying these chemicals in the bathroom or washing them with your hands, and you're just touching them for a second, but that's going in through your skin and getting into your body and staying there. So at any rate, the Canadians are going to have 5,000 people studied over a two-year period to determine the level of toxins and chemicals in their bodies. And the question is, once they're in there, how do you get them out? We know from fish, for example, that the big fish have high levels of mercury in them. And you should only eat small fish. If you catch a great big 20 or 30 pound fish, it's not good to eat that fish, and especially you should remove any of the flesh that's down around the stomach area, because that's where all those toxins congregate. So at any rate, fish and sea life that we use for food is many times highly toxic, especially the bigger ones, whether they're from the ocean or from a freshwater lake. But at any rate, this topic is going to become bigger and bigger with time, just because more information is coming out. The Canadians were disturbed to find that DDT and other chemicals that were banned decades ago are still turning up in the water supply. They don't go away. So it's amazing what is in our water supply. And once again, I just think it's imperative that people start learning that they need a water filter, that they need to take care of their own water supply. And if we ever have problems, whether they're political, whether they're physical, where we have a natural catastrophe, whether it's a large worldwide catastrophe or it's localized, the biggest thing you need is your own water supply. And also clean water. So I believe it's even in the Bible, it says one of these days in the future, a glass of clean water will be the most precious thing on earth. I just wanted to talk, and I had this idea after the Virginia Tech shooting, after reading today that, yesterday, what was about another 170 people, civilians in Iraq, were blown up by bombing. Little children, something like 40 or 50 children, were killed by a Clorox bomb, and I don't even know what that is, but all these little children dying, and I'm thinking, this world is a world of madness that we live in. And so, many times, the talk shows are centered on the bad things that are going on. I just wanted to somewhat reverse this, and for just a minute, talk about what things really could be like and should be like on this planet. So to do that, I'm going to make up a hypothetical planet, and I'm going to call it Threya. That's Earth backwards. Threa. I've kind of mixed the letters up a little bit, but I pronounce it Threya. And it's a planet where everything is backwards from the way things are going today. And that's why I turned the word Earth around. It's a, I don't know if other people have ever had this idea for a concept to try and illustrate, but imagine a planet where the politicians are dedicated towards helping the people, especially the poorest people, where businesses come to the government and say, how can we use our resources to help the people of the world? This is backwards from what is going on today. Now businesses go to the governments and say, how can you get us into these foreign countries with great resources but very poor populations so we can hoard those resources and get them out for the largest amount of profit for our company? That's what's going on today. imagine the planet Theia, where the corporations would go to the government and say, we're doing very well, we have profits more than what we know what to do with, we don't want them, we're not going to put this money in our own pockets, how can we help the poor people of the world? How can we go over there and make sure they have clean water and food? And if they don't, what can we do to get it to them? Let's take another example on the planet Theia, that we know global warming is occurring, but instead of running around and having concerts, what we do is get the scientists together, and instead of the scientists getting year after year of grant money and publishing papers and flying around on scientific vacations, the scientists get together and say, we've got to capture this water that's melting off the ice caps, and we have to preserve it because that's our only supply of really good fresh water. How can we get that water from where it's melting in Greenland or Antarctica? How can we get that to the Sahara Desert? Imagine the value that the Earth would have if all of a sudden we could make the deserts bloom again. But today on Earth, it's just the opposite. Desertification, or the creation of desert by the unobstructed encroachment of man, is causing a tremendous problem. And if you've ever lived in the tropics, once an area becomes desert, it's almost impossible to regain that land and make it bloom again because of the fact that the sun beats down on it and the heat rises, the clouds don't come in low enough to drop moisture, and so as a result it doesn't rain there. If you have the green lush forest there, it's absorbing that sunlight. It cools down the air, the moisture-laden clouds from the ocean come in and rain on that area. So on the planet Theia, there would be a group of people who wanted to reclaim the deserts and not cut down any more wood or forests or plants. They would want to create a thriving growth scenario on the edge of these deserts and make them reverse to where the deserts became usable land. Remember that the Sahara Desert only a couple thousand years ago was a vast forest, but the Romans went in and cut it down so they could build ships for their navies. That's why the Sahara Desert now is what we see today. How many school books talk about that? It wouldn't be very good because the very books they're reading out of come from paper mills where the logging industry and the paper and the pulp industry and the tree harvesting industries are going full bore to cut down every last piece of timber that we have in the world. It's estimated that by the year 2009, between China and the United States, the last forests will have been cut down completely. So, at any rate, back to the island of Theia. There was a legendary, and possibly not so legendary, continent called Mu. Lemuria is another longer name that existed, according to legend, at the same time as Atlantis. Now, Atlantis existed in the South China Sea. That was the home of the mother continent of Atlanta. Lemuria lay in the Pacific Ocean, west of the Hawaiian Islands, where the Hawaiian Islands are today, and between there and Japan. That's where the legendary continent of Lemuria existed. And they were very conscious of the environment. They provided a society that was very tuned to the earth and coordinated with the earth. They spent most of their time harmonizing with the other people instead of running around like we do in a rat race, thinking that we have to buy a better car next year, a bigger house, or keep up with some other form of economic you know, sustenance, buying, you know, things that we really don't need, a bigger television or, you know, whatever it is, a bigger stereo system, a bigger SUV, whatever the end result, the people of Thraya learned how to live with their environment. Now, we're going to have to do that too, because the earth is running out of resources. The military is using a vast amount of resources, and it's going into a proverbial black hole. This planet cannot sustain the use of resource consumption that it has been undergoing over the past decades. It's going to break down. We already see it break down. We see sea life dying offshore because of the damage that the human population has done to this planet. So the one thing I can say about global warming effort is that it is making people aware that we have to turn this planet around and create a planet that is a green planet. And the only problem is that the global warming scenario is being used for the control of fresh water by a few. It's going to be the biggest business on the planet in years to come. And that's one reason why I oppose the global warming media blitz that is currently going on. I want people to be aware that the real reason for this is to create a control scenario for water, for fresh water, when in fact we have a vast overabundance of fresh water. You notice that whenever global warming is mentioned, the first thing they say right after it is drought. Drought, lack of fresh water. If there's global warming, then all of the ice caps are melting and we have an absolute overabundance of fresh water. It's just that we're not doing the proper things with that fresh water. We have more fresh water now available to us than ever in the history of the planet. It's simply not managed correctly. So that's one of the issues that I want to keep pounding on, is that the global warming issue is a front for control of water. You'll see this more and more, and you'll see everybody from the United Nations down to your friendly local government getting in on the act, basing it on the global warming scenario. Okay, I'm going to talk for the last couple of minutes of this show about something, and I want to give you a little background. First of all, the topic is, what would it take to overrun the United States with force? In other words, from a foreign army. And actually, it's a pretty daunting task, even if you had superior air power and that type of thing, in the year 2007. I want to lead back to a time when I was in Los Alamos National Laboratories as a guest. I was there on an invited speaking tour, and I was talking about my comet work. And my particular talk was in the afternoon. So the morning I spent with, I was there actually a couple days, I spent the time with the high energy bomb group, and these were scientists who made calculations of death tolls based on nuclear explosions. That's what they did at Los Alamos. And so in the process, I learned the techniques and the statistical techniques for determining death rates based on bombs. Now, this is not something that was really something I was interested in learning about, but I was there, and I found it extremely interesting that you could actually make, you know, detailed calculations based on factors, all kinds of factors of initial death tolls or initial damage control, that type of information. And you could actually estimate, based on populations and the type of available resources that a population would have, what the overall effects would be. So with that in mind, I sat down one day and I said, what would it take for a foreign army to take over the United States? And then I started with one particular example, and that was New York City. And I thought, what would it take logistically to take over and secure and hold? That's three different things. To take over and logistically hold New York City, just New York City proper. This is not New Jersey. This is not the expanded area. I'm just talking about New York City and Manhattan Island. It would take around 3 million troops to secure and hold New York City alone. Now, look at all of the other populations around the country. The United States is a big spread out country. And so it would take a tremendous effort and a good deal of logistics and support, including supply lines, for an army of any kind, and it would have to be a foot army, a land army, to take this country. So you would need literally to take the entire country, probably half the population of China would have to come here. But the more people that you would bring in to control the United States, the more logistic problem you have of supplying and keeping that army supplied with food and water and everything that that army would need to maintain its control. And so it brings up the point that maybe if this kind of a scenario were to take place, that the invading army would not be intended to stay here permanently. They would only be intended to take over and establish a certain level of law and order. And after that, they would be expendable because the people in power simply could not, or would not, or could not supply such an army. It's a very interesting point. But the question, once again, what would it take logistically? And this is even if you had superior air power, if you had other types of modern weaponry, any field commander knows that no matter what kind of modern exclusive weaponry you have, and Iraq is proving this point dramatically, given all of the high-tech equipment and weapons, etc., that the U.S. Army has at their disposal, they're still having a difficult time maintaining the poorest third-level country or third-rate, third-tier country in the Mideast, which is Iraq and Afghanistan. With all the resources of the U.S. military, they can't contain that small country with a population of a few million people. So now take the United States, much of which is heavily armed. People are hunters. People have all kinds of weapons. And that's why the people in power in the world are trying desperately to get gun laws in place. Because, for example, when the United States invaded Japan, or they were going to invade Japan at the end of World War II, they did not do it because every man, woman, and child in Japan had a handgun or some type of weapon. And that's why the United States did not invade Japan, because the losses to the American troops would have been unbelievably high. So once again, I'll probably talk about this in future shows. What would it take logistically to take the United States and hold it? It's logistically an extremely daunting, large project, and there are some very great difficulties because once you try and establish supply lines, the people are going to start nabbing those supplies because they will need the supplies. At any rate, I am out of time once again. Talk to you next week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.